I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Tara Marconi is angry. Her mother has died. She's estranged from her father. And her relationship with her boyfriend, Connor, is going nowhere. She wants to disappear from her life in South Philadelphia and heads off to Alaska. That's how our guest, Brendan Jones, begins his debut novel, The Alaskan Laundry. The title refers to something a character says, that everyone comes north to Alaska to get clean of their pasts. Brendan Jones grew up in Philadelphia, went to Alaska when he dropped out of college. He, like Tara, works in commercial fishing and, like her, makes Alaska his home on a tugboat. And Brendan Jones joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you back with us. Or I should say, nice to have you back in Philadelphia and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for being here. It is such a thrill to be on the show.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And this was about 10 years in the making, right? This novel?
It was. Yeah, I started in, I guess, about 2005.
Does that seem like a long time?
It does. You know, a lot of that time was spent doing work, carpentry or the commercial fishing, like you were saying, just to find the time to write this. But it was a long time in the making, and just the fact that it's here now and something you can hold in your hands is so cool.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section from the book. This is really the chapter two, the very first couple of paragraphs.
Sure. After spending most of the muggy Philadelphia summer in Connor's room, scooping water ice during the day, raging about her father at night, she couldn't take it anymore. The it being herself, subsisting on wheat thins and chive cream cheese, hardly getting out of her torn sweatpants, taping episodes of the X-Files to watch over and over, showering only when she and Connor started sleeping together. She had thought the sex would help, and it did, briefly. But after the rush of blood and warmth, she only felt emptier. And she wanted to disappear like the dot when she turned off her TV, reduced to a point. To reanimate on some different planet, find some new sun to orbit. Connor tried to help, going out to fetch another box of crackers and a block of cream cheese. She heard once more that he was there if she needed to talk. She thought she might scream. One day in early August, while Connor was at his job bricklaying, she woke up barely able to catch her breath. And at first she thought she was having a heart attack or her lungs were shutting down. The walls seemed to close in, and she panicked. And that same day she tracked down her cousin, Ocuzio Marconi, in Santa Fe. She remembered his stories about working in what he called the last frontier, catching salmon with his bare hands, running in the grizzlies, working at the hatchery, and then a fish processor. "Place is huge," he said. "Instead of America, it should be called Alaska and its 49 bitches." Her father at the far end of the table, silencing Ocuzio with a glare. "Are there girls too?" Tara asked, from her chair beside her mother. "Well, if they're born there. But it's a man's world. Shows you what you're made of." Afterward, as they did dishes in their burnt orange and avocado formica kitchen, her mother shut off the faucet and took Tara by the shoulders. "This young man, your cousin, he don't know nothing. Alaska is like where I come from, where these..." Her mother held up her hands and spread long, sudsy fingers in front of Tara's face, her nickel-sized medallion dangling over her breasts. "These are how you grow strong, see? It doesn't matter what is here." She patted between her thighs. "Capisce?"
I love that reading. And that's Brendan Jones, again, reading from his debut novel. It's called The Alaskan Laundry. Are you surprised that your main character turned out to be a woman, Tara?
None more than I mean, I started with these 10 different characters. There was a carpenter named Level, and there was a young commercial fisherman. And I mean, if you had told me 10 years ago that I was going to be writing a female protagonist, I would have laughed. But it was over the course of writing this, it was almost like a war of attrition between these characters. I wrote 10,000 words for each of them and then started colliding them together.
Oh, wow.
And then one would kind of peel away. And when I ended up getting the agent for the book, he suggested, oh, yeah, there was a Cuban salsa dancer named Santiago. And he said, well, maybe the story is just about the relationship between Tara and Santo. It was a love story. And then when I got my editor at Houghton Mifflin, she said, well, you know, I wonder if the story is just about Tara. And all of a sudden, I was like, I have a female protagonist. Oh, my gosh. This is crazy.
I mean, did it feel, as the writer, easier, harder to get to know her? Or was she already sort of created in your imagination so you didn't have to think harder about, okay, now that I have this lead character who's a woman, I have to know something about the female persona or something.
I'll say two things. First, that I definitely did need to think hard. It was, and a lot of that came down to craft and just learning the craft of writing a novel I didn't know, especially before going into the Stegner workshop, this fellowship at Stanford, how much just technique it took to and having mentors like Tobias Wolff and Elizabeth Talent and Adam Johnson just made, not to mention the other workshop mates, made all the difference. I was at the back of the bus, full stop. I mean, all these kids had MFAs and I did not. On the other hand, I will say that I grew up in a household with my mother and my sister, and you know, I noticed some things, so maybe that helped.
Right. In fact, you dedicate to my mother, Kathy Gosliner, and her red pen.
And that's literal, because I would give her a piece of writing, and it would just come back dripping with blood. Yeah.
Wow. And with obvious suggestions for how you could do this better.
Suggestions is a nice word for it.
Yeah. Those were directions.
Directions, yeah. They've steadily over time maybe become suggestions. But
the title of this novel is intriguing, The Alaskan Laundry. When I picked it up, I obviously had no idea what you were referring to. But this idea, and I wonder, it's certainly true in Tara's case. I don't know if it's true in your case, or maybe people, outsiders, who are attracted to Alaska because they do want it disappear from their life, or they do want to leave their life behind, start new, start afresh, feel tested perhaps in a different kind of way in this Alaskan environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I should start off by saying that a third of the people who live in Sitka are Tlingit, and they have been very happily
there. This is where you live, yes.
For 10,000 years, yeah. Sitka is where my wife and I live. But there are so many people who come to Alaska and jump into this, an old fisherman said, it's kind of like a washing machine on continuous cycle.
Yeah. And someone said this to you, right?
Yeah, it was an old guy on the docks, an old salt out there, and it was just his kind of offhand observation that people come here to get clean and escape their past. And I mean, honestly, I think that that's why there's, I think, 15 reality shows filming as we speak in Alaska, because you have these people with these very complicated and fraught pasts coming up to this land, which presents its own challenges. And of course, that's great narrative material because you see these kind of laden people struggle. And are they going to go through the ice or aren't they?
Yeah.
How are they going to react?
Yeah. Well, and also part of this quote is, yes, it's this clean cycle, but you can also get dirty in the process, just to sort of complete the metaphor.
Absolutely. You can get dirty and you can get destroyed, beaten down. I mean, it's hard. But on the other hand, it's also a ring of fire. And especially, I think, for kids who are a little bit lost, as I certainly was, you go up there and you come back with a better sense of who you are in the world and what you're capable of.
I mean, were you trying to somehow clean your past, or was it just that you just didn't know what your future was or what you were doing with your life at the time and ended up in Alaska?
Yeah, I didn't know.
And I want to talk about Alaska as if it's Mars or something. I mean, it is part of the United States, right?
Yeah, it is. But they do refer to the rest of the U.S. as the lower 48 or the outside, you know, even. So it does really feel like a land unto itself, especially when you get out of Anchorage and into some of the smaller communities. But in answer to your question, I think I was definitely a lost cookie, confused, trying to find my sort of own rites of initiation as a kid. And Alaska just seemed, from everything I had read, the place to do. I mean, everything from my side of the mountain to shipping news to these stories of adventure, this kind of hero's journey. And of course, it doesn't work out, you know, all those prescribed steps just like that. But when I came back, and I went from Alaska, I had $1,500 and I decided to go overland through China and Southeast Asia and India. And
the circuitous route, right?
Yeah, you know, just stupid and outrageous. And when I got back, especially after getting really sick in India, I think I had my head on a little bit straighter.
Yeah. I mean, did you feel like you found yourself in Alaska, sort of like your character, Tara?
Yeah, there's this great, it's Neil Young, this line in a song, you know, this is where all my changes happened. And initially I thought, I mean, because I moved back to Philly and worked for 6 years here, mm-hmm. I thought Alaska was just kind of that place where those changes happen, and that was it. But, and that's very much what this book is about. I think after thinking about it, it really kind of became in my head more of a mm-hmm. home and a place to raise a family, which is what we're doing now. And just very much about strong community where people are looking out for each other.
The reading, Tara talks, we meet her mother. What do we need to know about her father? I mean, this is a fraught relationship and some really difficult times that they've had together.
Yeah. Her father, yeah, I don't want to give too much away in the book,
either.
But her father really wants to do right. Yeah. He wants to. He just doesn't have the tools. So one of the things that Tara does is she's a boxer. And when something happens to her, the father doesn't know what it is. And even worse than that, he doesn't really have the tools to ask what it is. But he takes her to the boxing gym, to his buddy, and gives her an outlet, which is kind of the best he can do.
But it's something.
It's something, and it's something, and it and there is a generosity of spirit in what he does there, but it's not enough.
In that reading, Tara's cousin says, you know, it's basically a man's world up in Alaska. Is there some truth to that, or is that, I know this is said a little bit in the past, does that feel a little dated and old-fashioned?
It does, it does, and not only in the last 10 years with so many women going up there and just kicking butt and working in the commercial fishing industry and being wildly successful, but also in the past. I mean, for this book, I interviewed some of the women who were fishing in the 60s and the 70s. And one thing that was extraordinary is that they said it didn't matter that we were women. What mattered is that we were catching fish. That's what people cared about right. when we tied up to the tender and we had, you know, 20,000 pounds of, you know, salmon. That's what people noticed. And I think that's something that's really unique in Alaska. I lived in New Hampshire for a bit and really miss this. People do not care what schools you went to, where you come from. All they care about is how you integrate yourself into the community, how hard you work, and how good a person you are.
Well, I mean, those are important things, but kind of liberating, isn't it, to think that you don't need a degree on the wall?
No, you
don't. From a fancy university, for instance.
Yeah, you don't. It's very freeing.
That's Brendan Jones, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. I grew up here in Philadelphia, lives now in Sitka, Alaska, and he has worked in commercial fishing. He's also worked as a general contractor, building as well, and now he's a novelist. He's got a brand new book. It's his first book, his first novel, and it's called The Alaskan Laundry. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And I should add that he has a radio show in Sitka, Alaska as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Brendan Jones. He grew up here in Philadelphia, lives now in Sitka, Alaska. He's worked as a woodworker, a commercial fisherman, a hunter. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Plowshares, Popular Woodworking, Huffington Post, and he's got a new book. His very first, it's a novel called The Alaskan Laundry. So much of this book is about Tara going to Alaska and working in commercial fishing, specifically salmon. I know that's something that you did as well. And I have to say, you know, we go to the supermarket to get that Alaskan salmon and what it takes to get that into the fish, into the supermarket is just extraordinary. Take us from the beginning, how it starts.
Sure, and it might be worthwhile just kind of following Tara a little bit in this book. She works her way up the ladder of the commercial fishing industry. So there's the salmon hatchery.
Right.
And then she graduates from there and she starts work at the seafood processor, the cannery. I think Hillary Clinton said that she spent some time there working on the slime line as well. And then there's a tender which collects fish from smaller boats. She works on the tender, and then eventually she moves on to a troller.
Yeah.
And then finally, a crabber, you know, way up in the Bering Sea. So, like you say, it's a long journey for a fish from a boat into the supermarket. And that really depends on, you know, without getting into it too much, how the fish is caught, whether it's trolled, whether it's seined, whether it's trawled, whether it's gill netted. And they're all different types of fisheries. I was in a store the other day, and I asked, just curious, they were selling sockeye salmon, wild Alaskan, how it came to be in their freezer case right there. I said, it's a trawler. I said, really? You know, trawlers are, you know, they just destroy the bottom of the ocean floor, and they just pick up all sorts of fish, and there's a ton of bycatch. And then he went back, and he said, no, I actually asked about it. It's not a trawler. It's pole caught. People are, you know, taking poles out there. I'm not sure that people are really aware where the fish is coming from. People I've seen on the menus, wild Atlantic salmon, and that doesn't exist either.
Oh, it doesn't?
It just doesn't exist. I mean, maybe little pockets in Ireland, you can get a couple wild, or maybe Norway. But because of the fish farms, they've really eradicated their wild stocks.
Well, so while we're talking about buying salmon, so what do we look for then?
Well, definitely
that's sustainable and
yeah,
supports a commercial industry, I guess, to some degree.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's a good part of it too. Wild Alaskan salmon,
okay,
wild Alaskan salmon, and asking how it's caught, that is really important. Trolling is line caught. Responsible, you know, management of a fishery. And I should say that the fishery in Alaska is managed by the state. And we had a record year of pinks the couple years back. And it's being successfully managed right now. And it's written into the state constitution that we have a responsibility to do that.
Tara's a boxer.
Yeah.
You're a boxer, or you certainly trained as a boxer. Does being a boxer help working in the fishing industry?
I think
you use
so.
Those kinds of muscles?
You do. And even more than that, it's just a lot of time alone, especially on a troller. And for better or worse, oftentimes for worse, I've been attracted to sports where it's just one person out there.
Uh-huh.
And boxing, you have these kind of sprints, these rounds, and it's really similar to being out there trolling. They're kind of these bursts of energy when you get in the fish, and then you have to settle down and wait until the fish hop on again.
There's a lot, I mean, as you write about it, there's a lot of kidding and camaraderie and ribbing that goes on. And I'm assuming you're off the coast, it's cold, you're on a trawler together. That's a natural occurrence.
Yeah, being out there with usually it's just one or two other folks.
Yeah.
And in a troller. Definitely. Like a trawler, for example, tried to unload in Sitka and the town almost rioted.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the idea of a trawler unloading, because they're such destructive, they destroy so much of the salmon population. And it's tricky, right? Because troller, it's a couple letters. But trollers is actually where you're fishing with lines behind you and you're catching each fish individually on a hook.
As opposed to trawler.
Trawling.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I missed that.
Right.
That distinction.
It is a distinction. And it's a tough one to make. But if you see the boats, you wouldn't miss it. They're just totally different beasts.
Tara, in the beginning of the novel, she doesn't like dogs, but she ends up with a dog, Kita.
Kita.
Does everyone have a dog in Alaska? I mean, is a dog an important part of?
I think they call them starter children. You know,
really? That's true down in the lower 48,
too,
I think.
That's not really different,
yeah.
Is it? That's true. The winters are long, and if you don't have a partner, you need a dog to snuggle.
Do you? So, just to keep you warm?
Just to keep you, especially those huskies. They're furry and warm and don't mind being kind of hugged. So
yeah.
A lot of people have dogs.
Is there a way to describe the cold? Or as is described in this novel, I mean, when winter sets in, I mean, the light disappears largely. You get the sort of a certain kind of light during the middle of the day, but then it's dark and cold.
It's dark, it's cold, and especially in Sitka, it's wet. Right? I mean, Sitka's in the largest intact rainforest in the world, the Tongass. It's 17 million acres. And it's hard to escape the rain and just the wetness getting into your bones. It's not that different from Philly,
yeah.
You know.
Less longer, though, I would assume.
That's true. Yeah, the nights are longer. And I actually love, especially on the island, and I think my wife would say the same, I love the winters because people really band together. And I've had friends come to Sitka and say, gosh, you know, nobody settles down and has good conversations here, talks to you. But that's because it's the summer and people are just jazzed up on the sunlight. And in the winter, it's really a seasonal thing. People settle down, their voices get quieter, conversations grow longer, and the whole kind of rhythm of life changes.
And is that just because it's so cold or you're indoors and that sort of sense of survival or togetherness, perhaps?
It's just dark and miserable.
It's just dark, right?
Yeah, that's just what it is. And we, my wife and I live on a tugboat, and it's way out at the end of the docks. And we've got a wood stove, and people come out there, and we just, it's called visiting. You know, people just knock on your door and hang out, and it kind of gives you sustenance through those long winter nights. And Sitka is very open, like I just said, but if you haven't done a winter in Sitka, you know, folks aren't really going to take you that seriously.
Tara, during this novel, has her eye on a tugboat that she wants. You, as you mentioned, live in a tugboat with your wife and your child. I'd love to have you read another section from the book. And I should say to our listeners that the town is not Sitka in this novel. It's Port Anna. But this is Tara and the Tug, I guess. Right?
Yeah, Tara and the Tug. Back in Port Anna, the storm was the news on the docks. A skipper and deckhand had stripped naked to keep each other warm in the woods after their boat sank off Chatham Strait. A young troller floated in a tote for 2 days before being picked up by the Coast Guard helicopter. Also, Petrie told her, a boat tied up on the transient float near the Pacific Chief had sunk, its tie-up lines wrenching at the dock. The harbor master had been the one to cut the rope, releasing the Dancing Fox into the deep. Tara gave Laney a call. Tug's still for sale, the woman said. How's the savings going? 2 weeks king crabbing and I'll have it. I'm rooting for you, lady. It rained well into September. Salmon berries turned moldy, purple knots over the river. Chalky carcasses of fish melted into the sandbanks. She and Keita stayed on the Revenge, waking early in the morning in the rainy gray to take day trips for chum. Fishing tough, Zachary called it, working through the wind and rain. They filled the hold quickly with the greenish tiger-striped salmon, saving time by pig-sticking the gills instead of dressing, plunging the fish in the slush instead of icing each one individually. She had developed a routine on the boat, giving Keita his kibble and then his hip pills, plugging in the space heater and drying her socks by hanging them on the netting over the bunk each night, stowing books about various disasters at sea by her head. In the morning, she strolled the docks with a mug of coffee, checking on the Pacific Chief. You still thinking of wasting your money on that slab? Petrie asked. Jesus, there you are, learning to fish on one of the best trollers in the fleet, and you want a tugboat. You don't think before you punch, do you? He gave her a winning smile. Come on, make me an offer on the Invictus. Start out with something that makes you money instead of costs you. Yeah, but a fishing boat isn't a home.
And again, that's our guest, Brendan Jones, reading from his new novel, and it's called The Alaskan Laundry. And in many ways, Tara is looking for a home.
She is. She is. And the book, I think, is very much a meditation on that and a meditation on what home means and this whole concept of nostos, you know, this idea of homecoming. And she's trying to figure out whether home is something you can create through your own hard work in Alaska, or whether it's something that you're born with or born into.
Or whether it's about the people in your life, right?
That's right. Yeah, very much so. Very much so. You know, the role that they play and how they interact with you and how good they are to you.
And this idea of homecoming, I mean, the sort of there's ancient literature that's all about homecoming.
Yeah, yeah, of course, Odysseus. And I actually started the book. I mean, my first book, I took Hamlet and I tried to set it in the Alaskan woods, and
did you really?
Terrible, just awful. But
it's
this book,
though,
it was conceived again with a male protagonist, but as this Odyssean adventure, and there are different characters. You'll recognize the King Bruce on the Crabber has one eye, so of course he's the Cyclops, and there's another seductive character who's Circe, and you know, these different stages of this hero's journey.
We have a Facebook comment from Josephine. She says, when I entered Alaskan territory in 1973 after hitchhiking all the way by car, boat, and plane, there was an overwhelming sense of having come home. The Alaskan pipeline had not begun yet. It was a real frontier town. The outstanding feature was the acceptance of any mode of being without judgment. Yes, liberating.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
I love that idea of liberation.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel that? I mean, you know Philadelphia, obviously know Alaska as well, or certainly Sitka, Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel more free up there?
I think just by nature of living in 17 million acres of rainforest, I mean, it's like having Germantown in a state the size of West Virginia, and Germantown is just it. You know, so it's a small community kind of nestled into the woods, and you leave town on a skiff and you look back and it's just a little diamond of light and the rest is just darkness.
Wow.
So it's very humbling, and you know, you learn over time that to carry a gun in the woods because bears will come into your camp and bears can be unfriendly. You just learn to exist in a different way and free. But I think that there's also living with a bit more fear, but that translates into a certain presence in life,
mm-hmm.
which is something that both my wife and I wanted to pass down our daughter.
And the idea of fear is it grizzlies? Is it just that you're living, you're this big in nature, which is this big?
Yeah.
The scale, in a way?
It's not only grizzlies. I mean, that's a part of it. I mean, the last couple of weeks I've been in Wrangell working on my boat, replanking the tug, and in the space of 2 days I lost one friend who went out on a kayak at 10 in the evening and just never came back.
Oh,
and
goodness.
Another guy who I knew boarded a float plane and crashed into the side of a mountain same day. I mean, so it's,
wow.
Everything is very immediate, and there's a good side and a bad side to that. But it's just something, it's just part and parcel of living in a place like that.
I'm looking at a picture of your tug. This is in the Inquirer, a story that you did about living on this tugboat with your family. The Adak.
The ADAC, yeah.
ADAC.
Uh-huh.
Is that a name that you came up with? Or
no, it's actually, it's the original World War II Army Harbor name of the tug.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's an island, of course, in the Aleutian Islands. And I just found out the other day it means father in the Aleut language. Who knew?
Yeah. What's it like on the inside of your tug?
Oh, it's beautiful. Geez, that boat just seduced me from the time I stepped into it.
Really?
It's 2,000 square feet of living space. It's got these oak varnished cabinets and this wonderful stateroom that just light pours in the summertime, of course. It's waterfront property. There's a view of the volcano. And it's gotten to the point where the baby loves falling asleep on the boat because there's that rocking sensation. So it's just a special place to live. You know, on the flip side, we don't have a refrigerator in the galley because in the winter it's cold enough and you don't really need a refrigerator.
Right. The great
galley.
Refrigerator in the sky,
that's
right?
Yeah. But we love it on there.
I mean, is it also the sound? I'm imagining the sound of sort of water on the lapping on the sides of the tug. Do you feel that? Do you hear that?
Water's always lapping, and there's a sea lion named Earl who sometimes cruises around and peeks up, and the dog and, you know, barks at him, and there are otters hanging out, and there's a whale in the harbor the other day. It's a great place to be. And of course you're always worrying that something's going to happen to the tug, or you never really know. But it's been a great place for us.
And do you worry about your daughter, or is it just, I mean, this is what it's like in Alaska, right?
You know, we, especially because we live on the tug, we're able to spend so much time with her and near her, and with an eye on her. So of course there's worry, as I was just saying, fear. It's just kind of built into, living there. It has been a monumental challenge to baby-proof that tugboat.
Oh, my goodness.
And she's just starting to walk, so Rachel
good
and
luck
I
with
are
that.
Scratching our heads trying to figure out how to get crab netting over the stanchions and rails around the hatches and all sorts of things. But, man, each morning she pulls herself up by the threaded rods on the portholes and gazes out over the water and checks out the weather, and I think she loves it on there.
Yeah. Now, you grew up in Philadelphia. Philadelphia Row House?
Yeah, Rome 20th and Lombard.
Right. So that was your tugboat or your backyard? Or
it was. I also had an uncle, and he had a farm up in Danville, Pennsylvania, north central Pennsylvania. And I loved to go up there and lurk around the barn. There was a pond, and he'd give me a .22 to kind of aim at snapping turtles and catch minnows. And I just love being a feral kid up there. So I think when I went to Alaska, it was definitely with expanding on that time in mind.
There's a character in this novel, an indigenous character that sort of teaches Tara about a number of things, but also just what it means to live off the land.
That's right, yeah.
And the sea, yeah.
Better Year.
Better Year, yes.
Yeah, he's just got an encyclopedic knowledge of the flora and fauna in Port Anna. And he really is a mentor figure, which is, you know, part of that whole hero's journey. You know, you leave the ordinary world and you find a mentor who takes you into this special place and teaches you the, you know, what it means to live there.
Did you have one of those, a mentor in Alaska?
I had a buddy who was like Errol Flynn, still is like Errol Flynn. I mean, I was in the woods and he kind of jumps out and he appears and he said, "Hey, you don't have to live on land. You can live in the woods. You know, you don't have to live in town. You can live in the woods." And he taught me how to, I spent 9 months living in the woods in Alaska to the great horror and dismay of both my parents. But he taught me how to do that in a hut and then in a tent. And I sincerely had no idea what I was doing. I burnt down the tent originally and trying to prime a stove. And he was, if anybody was, and there were a couple other folks who taught me more about hunting and stuff, but he was the guy who really helped me out.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Brendan Jones about, in part, growing up here in Philadelphia, also in living in Alaska, where he lives on a tugboat in Sitka, Alaska, with his wife and young child. And he has written a novel. It's his first book. It's called The Alaskan Laundry. And in part, was able to write it because of a writing program in California at Stanford. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, again talking with Brendan Jones about his debut novel called The Alaskan Laundry. It's about Tara Marconi. She is living in South Philadelphia when we first meet her, and she ends up in Alaska, in a sense, coping with her mother's death, also dealing with her difficult relationship with her father, finding her home on a tugboat in Alaska. You had mentioned the fact that you lived in the woods for 9 months, and there was this person who helped you. I mean, was he also living in the woods, or was he just this apparition that would appear and tell you not to burn your tent down?
Yeah. He had lived in the woods at the time. He was raising a couple kids, but he had spent significant time living in the woods. And he was also familiar with this group of folks who lived farther up the river than I did. And they lived in a place called the Chateau, which was this kind of labyrinth of plywood and trash bags and tarps. And there may be 25 people living up there, kind of this post-apocalyptic crew. Wow. They were trying to just live on deer and fish and making all their tools out of bone. And I lived, I guess, about 5 miles down the river from them. But he was the one who kind of introduced me to that whole world.
And certainly we read about having what freezers full of all sorts of wild animals, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you open somebody's freezer in Sitka. And this is both because it's great to go harvest food and subsist, but also because food's really expensive on the island.
Just because of what it takes to get it there,
yeah,
I guess?
Exactly. But yeah, it's venison and salmon berries and fish, salmon, halibut and ling cod. People's freezers are packed.
Can you make a cheesesteak out of venison?
You can.
And that was a very leading question, because this was also in the profile that you wrote in the Inquirer.
They're really, really good. I feel like somebody should get on that in Philadelphia. Venison cheesesteak, especially using backstrap, it's such a lean meat. And man, you smother it with whiz. It just takes off.
Oh, my
God.
Oh, with the whiz. You got to take the whiz up to Alaska, right?
Yeah, because you can't get good whiz up there. That's true.
You mentioned the fact that Sitka is in the middle of an Alaskan rainforest, 17 million acres, the largest temperate rainforest in the world.
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I guess for us silly people down here in the lower 48, the idea of a rainforest in Alaska, we think of that as a more tropical thing. But, I mean, clearly it's thriving, it's rainy.
Right? Yeah. Well, Alaska, I mean, first off, it's 2.5 times the size of Texas, and it'll stretch from one border to the other, from Rhode Island to Los Angeles. So it's, I mean, it's huge.
Yes.
It's just a huge space. It has its own time zone. So down south in what they call Southeast Alaska, it is a forest of spruce and hemlock and alder and cedar.
Wow.
And it will get 150, even 200 of 200 inches of rain a year. Seattle gets maybe 90, you know, so it just rains a lot there. People call it liquid sunshine.
Wow.
And when there's a little patch of blue, they call those sucker holes for the suckers who think it might actually get sunny.
So you have to learn to love rain?
You have to learn to love rain. And on days when the sun comes out, everybody plays hooky and just enjoys the beautiful weather. But a sunny day in Sitka will make you a believer. My mother has visited 2 times, and both times it has rained. Mm-hmm. And it's just so painful. I just wanted to see a sunny day in Sitka.
Is it helpful to write in Alaska? I mean, and I'm thinking of those long cold nights that you, or long winter nights that you seem to enjoy, or days, I guess, that you seem to enjoy. Is that conducive to writing?
I think so. Like you say, especially the winter. And when I left Philadelphia in 2011 and sold my home in South Philly and my business, it was just with the goal of taking advantage of those long winter nights and just writing the heck out of it. That said, there are a lot of distractions, and there's not a strong writing community, but you don't necessarily get the art scene, like I'm stating the obvious, that you would in Philadelphia or Seattle. My wife and I were just over in Franklin Park enjoying the Lantern Festival and taking our daughter on a merry-go-round.
I mean, yeah. You don't have that in Sitka.
You don't have that in Sitka. No.
Let me read a Facebook comment from Susan. She says, my father was stationed in Adak and Attu during World War II. He was a doctor in the Army Air Corps. The minute he arrived on base, he was told that every man had heartburn. Daddy went immediately to the kitchen and looked in the coffee pot. He ordered the cooks to clean the pot thoroughly with soap and water. Heartburn cured.
Wow.
Yeah. So something else you can put
into your
next novel.
I'm taking notes right now. That's wonderful. Thank you for that.
This is something that you wrote for the New York Times. It goes back to a couple of months, to January 2016. This is about this rainforest. But it's also, I'll just quote here, the rivers and the salmon that carpeted in rainforests and braided with waterways, Southeast Alaska is among the largest wild salmon producers in the world. Its tourism and salmon fishing industries grossing about $2 billion a year. But today, the rivers and the salmon that create these jobs are threatened by Canada's growing mining industry along the mountainous Alaskan-British Columbia border, about 100 miles east of where you right now. So help us understand what is going on here and how much this is being threatened by Canada.
Yeah. Well, Canada, unfortunately, especially BC, they do not have strong environmental regulations on the development of mines. And as the boundary lines have been drawn between Alaska and British Columbia, these mines are perched right on the edge and very near the headwaters of the Taku and the Stikine and these major, major salmon rivers. So what happens, what has already happened in Mount Polly during the breach, is you have these tailings holdings where they collect all the heavy metals that are the results of mining copper and gold. And if there's a breach, as there was at Mount Polly, all these heavy metals, and in some cases acid, drains into these salmon streams. And the salmon are so sensitive to the pH of water. That's how they find their native streams when they're beginning to spawn, that they just get wiped out.
Wow.
They just get wiped out. And it's a huge problem, and it disrupts native collection of salmon that's been going on for thousands of years, not to mentioning threatening Alaska's fishing industry and tourism industry. So there's so much to that issue, and people in Alaska and myself, we've been hoping that Alaska and the United States will take the issue to the IJC, the International Joint Commission, which is built. It was established in 1909 to deal with water issues between two countries. I mean, that's its stated purpose.
Two allies here, obviously, Canada and the United States.
Yeah, two allies. But when it comes to river issues and water issues, of course, as we know, things get very fraught and difficult quickly.
I mean, is this a state issue, a federal issue, or is there some finger pointing going back and forth?
There is. The Minister of Mines, Bill Bennett, in Canada says, oh, it's an issue between Alaska and BC, and there is an MOU, a memorandum of understanding between the two, but it's toothless. It can't be enforced. So many folks, not necessarily the State Department, but the EPA, both senators in Alaska, want this to go to the IJC to be judged, this international commission. And it's really the mining industry that's been throwing money at it, trying to keep that from happening.
Wow. An email from Caden says, having lived with these characters, this book for 10 years, is there a sense of loss or grieving upon its completion or just accomplishment?
I miss the characters that I had to cut, I have to say.
Editing's hard, isn't it?
It's really hard. Yeah, it's really hard. I have a friend who, whenever he has to cut a character, he dresses up in a suit. And he sits down at the computer and he cuts the character. It's like a funeral, you know. And I miss Santo. I miss that Cuban guy and a couple of restaurant owners. Tara, I feel if you really do right by a character, then you lose control of them. And I don't know. I don't know what she's gonna do at this point. I feel like she's kind of herself, and folks have asked, oh, is there going to be a sequel? I want to know what Tara does. And I have no idea. Mm-hmm. I have my suspicions about whether she'll do this or that, stay in Alaska, go back to Philly. But I don't. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't know until writing it out.
I mean, there certainly are some parallels between you and Tara. I mean, having grown up in Philadelphia, being a boxer, working in commercial fishing, living on a tugboat. So do you feel like she lives inside you in part, or she is part of you, you part of her?
Well, characters, of course, in fiction are such an amalgamation of so many different people and so many different stories, so it's difficult to draw direct parallels. But that said, yeah, there are a number of parallels.
Yeah.
Of course, our gender is different, but I would say the biggest parallel is that when either of us enter into situations, we don't really know what we're doing, whether that be boxing or Alaskan. When I first got to Alaska, I had a job and I needed a vest. It was cold up there, and I went to the secondhand shop and I got this really cool vest. It's an orange vest, and I just thought it looked really cool on me. And I went into work and somebody kind of looked at me and said, "Why are you wearing a life vest to work?" You know? And
did you really do that?
I did. Yeah, I had a cool whistle on it and everything. And so you just do things and you don't really know what they're about, but they end up not only being educational, right, and you surely don't make that mistake again, but you also get stories out of it.
Are you a good salsa dancer?
Where did that come from?
Well, Santo was this character.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I have been to Cuba a few times. It's one of my favorite places. As it happens, I met my wife. I was teaching Cuban salsa in Alaska, which doesn't necessarily mean a lot.
You can do anything in Alaska.
You can do, I'm going to teach whatever I want to teach. People will show up. But she was in my class, and we ended up having a family together. So
nice.
During those long winter months, people do all sorts of stuff. And salsa class is one of them, just as a way to kind of keep warm and engaged with each other.
I mean, it's interesting as a writer that you not just knew manual labor, but that this is pretty you build things in construction, working commercial fishing. I mean, these are really demanding physical jobs. Is it helpful to have both? I mean, is it help to write the fact that you are so physical in other parts of your life?
I think there's a real connection between the two, and it's a great question. I find doing the writing in the morning and then working on the boat, they really balance each other well. And just to expand on that, I think there's a moral component to it too. I think that there's a responsibility a writer has to bear witness and to engage.
To live in the world, you
mean? To live in the world. And I would go so far as to say that I think literary fiction is in danger of becoming a decorative art. I think that it should be an expression of outwardness, connection and expansion. And I love F.R. Leavis has this idea that literature is the supreme means by which we renew our sensuous and emotional life and learn a new awareness. Like this idea of new awareness I'm just in love with. And I think if you're going to write that, then you do have to, you know, buy orange vests and get laughed at, or you do have to get out on the ocean and have no idea what you're doing and then report back about it.
Rather than sitting cloistered in a way for days on end writing about something like that.
Yeah, and I would never be so presumptuous as to judge, you know, how other writers go through their creative process. You know, Proust was in his Corcoran and any number of other writers have their own way of putting words on the page. But for me, I do think, especially in this moment when ecologically things are so fraught and tough, an ecological holocaust, I don't think is an exaggeration of what's going on. I think getting your hands dirty, especially if you're going to presume to write sort of dirt and grit American realism, I think that there's a responsibility to do that.
You mentioned that the numbers of reality shows about Alaska, what, a dozen, something like that?
15 is the last I heard, yeah.
Right. And did you work on some? Were you a camera person?
I didn't. Not a cameraman. When I did my company in Philadelphia, I ran a company. We were on 3 reality shows that filmed here. One actually filmed in New Jersey. So was introduced to that world. At one point, a production company was in contact about doing one on the tugboat. Uh-huh. And after doing those 3, I'm pretty certain that we didn't want to do that.
But do people in Alaska laugh at the reality shows about Alaska?
Oh, yeah. It's a running joke. It's a running joke. And not to say, I've actually seen a couple that can be really frighteningly good when it comes to character development and how these different characters react in the situation. But I mean, they work it up so much with music and drama and kind of coercing people. And you have the Alaskan bush people out there pulling a skate, which is something people do 9 times a day. And there's this Jaws music in the background. And are they going to succeed? Aren't they going to succeed? It's so tough. And you're just pulling a skate. You know?
So are you thinking about another novel?
Yeah, I have ideas. I have ideas for it, and also working on some nonfiction. Mm-hmm. I really get great pleasure out of writing the op-eds, and frankly, I feel like they have a much more immediate, you see much more immediate results. I mean, I heard that this article that you read from made it into Kerry's briefing packet. You
know? Oh, interesting.
And things like that.
Secretary of State Kerry.
Yeah, Secretary of State Kerry. Things like that make me want to continue in that vein. But creating Tara, characters like Tara, I do feel like I hope that she'll hit home with people and make them understand the wonder of Alaska.
Brendan Jones, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Congratulations on the book as well.
Thank you so much, Marty. It's been such a pleasure.
Nice to have you with us as well. And again, the novel is called The Alaskan Laundry. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Abby Sarfo, the intern for today's edition of Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. Radio Times produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.